From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. It can feel like everywhere you look, someone's accusing someone else of peddling fake news.
Well, the spread of the coronavirus, it's also led to a lot of spread of misinformation.
There are more rumors going around on social media about how to avoid the coronavirus. Eating garlic, drinking bleach.
Have you heard anything like that?
Yeah, it is totally, unfortunately, made up, and it is not true.
Fake news is the enemy.
It is fake news.
These charges and countercharges about inaccuracy, bias, and fabrication can seem modern. In fact, they're deeply rooted in the history of American journalism. But if there are similarities between the present and the past, there are also areas of sharp divergence.
I think there are consequential differences in what's going on now in the Trump administration, some very important and nerve-wracking differences.
This week on Hidden Brain, what the history of fake news in the United States reveals about an important tension at the heart of journalism. Should reporters think about their readers and listeners as consumers or as citizens? Should the media give people what they want or what they need? Later in the show, we'll look at a different problem in journalism. When nobody wants to pay for the press, who ultimately foots the bill? Andy Tucker is a professor at Columbia University, and she studies the history of what we now call fake news. Andy, welcome to Hidden Brain.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a story from your book, Froth and Scum. You describe a crime that took place one Sunday morning in 1836. What was the crime and how did it first come to light?
Early that morning, a young woman who lived at a house of prostitution in New York City was found hacked to death in her bed, and her body was set on fire. It was a sensational crime, as it would be in any era, but it became particularly frenzied and important because there was a new kind of newspaper in the city, and suddenly there was competition to cover a sensational story more sensationally than the next guy. It became what I think is one of the first media circuses in U.S. history to figure out who was the guilty party, who killed her and why.
So police arrest a guy, put him on trial, but very quickly, this new kind of newspaper, which is the penny press, springs into action. Editors serve up all the lurid details of the case, including several unverified claims, and insist that they're acting in the public good.
The public good was a really important part of how the new newspapers were covering this. They said, we're doing something really different. Newspapers before that had been generally very partisan. They were funded by political parties. They were operated by political party functionaries. They were an accepted part of the political system. The new penny press did something different. They said, we're just giving information to people who want information. We are not connected anywhere. We're free. We're independent. We can tell you anything. We're not bound by any political ties. So you have the right to know what's going on, and we're the ones who are going to tell you.
How did they go about covering the story?
Oh, it was quite a circus. There was no such thing as a reporter at that time. The political newspapers had an editor who kind of thought and wrote. Then the penny press had to invent the idea of the reporter, the person who went around doing shoe leather observation and investigation, poking around, asking questions, trying to get into the crime scene. All of this was brand new. Some people were horrified that these nosy little people were buzzing around being, you know, asking embarrassing questions and talking to people who were much higher than them in station. But a lot of readers thought this was just great. This was news that finally was catering to them. This was ordinary middle-class, working-class people who were not terribly interested in all of the Washington scandals and imbroglios, and this was what they wanted to know.
Bringing people what they wanted. Newspapers began to treat their audiences like consumers. They began to ask what their audiences might want to read and to shape their stories to cater to those demands. This sometimes meant a blatant disregard for the truth.
The Herald wanted a more respectable readership. The Herald wanted middle-class people. So the Herald decided that the nice middle-class young man who had been accused of the crime was actually innocent. He was a poor lamb who was being framed by evil and designing madams and police officers. The Sun was a newspaper much more closely tied to the working class. They wanted to give a story that was more appealing to the working class, which was this poor woman on the fringe of society is being abused and exploited by rich and powerful people. So they both looked at the same crime and had entirely different interpretations based on what they thought their readers would prefer to hear. In some ways, it's a very democratic approach to news. It's telling these readers, you can make up your own minds. You don't need smart elites to tell you this. So even though each newspaper kind of fudged and shaded the truth, they did it on the understanding that readers would choose one or the other. And that was part of their pitch. You can figure it out. You can decide. That was really exciting.
And of course, as you're talking right now, I'm hearing echoes to the present day where, you know, if you're a Democrat, you have your preferred cable news channel. If you're a conservative, you have your preferred cable news channel. It really is not that different than it was, you know, 200 years ago.
No, in some ways, it's very, very similar. There are patterns and resonances that recur and recur and recur.
By the end of the 19th century, journalism had become a sort of Wild West. There were very few rules for how reporters should operate.
This is the time of the Spanish-American War, and the Yellow Press, the very sensational press spearheaded by William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer in New York, and they're competing with each other. They are making up all sorts of stuff. It becomes so sensational that people begin to think of journalism as incapable of telling the truth. There are new technologies, too. There is the motion picture. Edison's film crews go down to Cuba in order to film, they say, to film what's going on. Turns out these new motion picture cameras are not very good. They're really clumsy. They don't take pictures well. So instead, what happens is Edison runs a lot of these little newsreels, actualities of what's going on in Cuba, but he actually stages them in the mountains of West Orange in New Jersey. So there's a lot going on that's really bad, and a growing understanding that journalism is at a crisis point, that nobody believes it.
So there are many forms of fake news that we can laugh about, but it's also clear that many journalism outlets have used fake news and accusations of fake news to push really disturbing agendas. You mentioned how the Atlanta Constitution had reported on lynchings, specifically the work of Ida B. Wells.
Yes, in 1894, the Atlanta Constitution had a headline in which it dismissed as fake news reporting by Ida B. Wells on a particularly gruesome lynching that involved African-American women and children. And Ida Wells was a crusading journalist who was exposing fearlessly the epidemic of lynching in the South. And the Atlanta Constitution, which was a very important, influential paper for the white South, was refusing to acknowledge this. And by using the term fake, dismissed her claims and made it very difficult to discuss the issue in public.
So at a certain point in American journalism, the virtues or the ideals of objectivity, neutrality, accuracy, these come to be seen as cardinal rules for the press. When did this happen and what prompted it?
That began at the very end of the 19th century, the very beginning of the 20th century, when objectivity and impartiality started to become news values. One of the key players here is the New York Times, which has just been bought by Adolf Oakes in 1896. And he decides he's going to make the New York Times a paper of record. He's going to make it the final arbiter in matters of fact. It's going to be trustworthy and it's going to be decent. One of its mottos, of course, all the news that's fit to print, but another of its mottos was, it will not soil the breakfast cloth. So he was making a real point of being decent and honorable, which went along with being more accurate.
But the interesting thing, of course, is that even as there are these new norms of fairness and objectivity, accuracy, the norm that basically publishing fake or fabricated news is wrong, this does not do away with the problem of fake news. In some ways, you could argue maybe it even exacerbates the problem. When you think about in more recent times, you know, the New York Times publishing reports citing unnamed sources that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, you know, you can't dismiss the New York Times as the penny press or the yellow press. This becomes part of the drumbeat that actually leads to war.
It's really complicated. Once a newspaper announces that it is going to be truthful, neutral, objective, once it announces it's going to be accountable, then it's faced with the real question, what happens if we get it wrong? How do you make up for that? Do you undermine your own credibility by acknowledging you made a mistake? Or do you undermine your own credibility by ignoring the fact that you made a mistake? So the fall of an authority, I think the sound that the authority makes when he smacks into the forest floor is much louder than the fall of a newspaper that has never been particularly known for accuracy.
You're at Columbia University's journalism school, and your school was called in to investigate a prominent story in Rolling Stone magazine. I want you to listen to this clip describing the results of the Columbia University study in Fox News.
This is being called a journalistic failure. Columbia University releasing its review of the discredited Rolling Stone article on an alleged gang rape at a University of Virginia fraternity house.
So in some ways, Andy, this feels like an echo of the 19th century where different publications were trading charges of fake news. Fox News is often accused of peddling fake news by the rest of the mainstream media. And here you have Fox News voicing outrage about fake news in another outlet. You know, history repeating itself, right?
Fake news can be used as an accusation. It can mean news that is honestly mistaken. It can mean news that is something I don't agree with. It can mean news that says something rude about somebody I support. Using fake news in any kind of debate has become almost ridiculous because it's talking past each other. But it seems to be an inevitable part of any kind of disagreement, of any kind of complaint about the press today.
One of the fascinating ideas in your work, Andy, is that journalists have resorted to fake news because they think it serves audiences and the public good. So if you needed to cover a devastating tornado in the 19th century, but the telegraph lines were down and the details of what happened were scarce, your choices were to either say nothing about the disaster or to try and imagine what happened.
Yes, there was a real debate about the term faking in the 1880s and 1890s, but it was a debate in which many journalists argued, faking is a good thing. By faking at that time, they didn't mean nefarious manipulation. They meant embellishment, adding some details, filling in gaps that they hadn't been able to see at the time, making an interviewee sound a little more articulate. It wasn't wholesale manipulation, but they argued that people would like that better because it gave them truth that was closer to what they expected, that it gave them stuff that wasn't boring, that nobody wanted a newspaper, said one handbook for journalists, nobody wants a newspaper to be a mathematical treatise. So in the beginning, this term fake news or faking of news was seen as something that journalists could do to make their readers happier.
In other words, if the mere recitation of the facts doesn't do justice to the truth, the honest journalist actually goes beyond the facts to try and represent the truth.
Yes, you can do a higher truth that way. And that's a term that we hear a lot, you know, somehow getting at a higher truth by glossing over inconvenient details. But this was a genuine movement in the early years of the professionalization of the press. There were professional journals in which this argument was made. Do it for your readers. They'll be happier. It's a little self-serving because it also meant that a journalist who was being a little lazy could get away with it. But in general, yes, there was a real sense that it was a good thing to do.
To be clear, in most newsrooms today, behavior like this will get a journalist fired. This sort of fabrication didn't just happen in newspapers. Andy has found that over and over, new technologies opened up new avenues for faking. The irony is, people always have faith that each new technology will make it harder to manipulate the truth.
early photography, when it first was announced in 1839, people like Edgar Allan Poe are talking about how real it is and how you could finally see more real than any kind of art. And within decades, you had someone like William Mumler, who was taking what he called spirit photographs. He would take a portrait of a person and go off and do things in the dark room and bring it back, and hovering over the shoulder of the person in the photograph would be the indistinct outline of someone he said was a spirit of a lost loved one. I don't know how, he said, but my camera can just pick up these spirits, these ghosts, and they show up in the picture. And people loved that. This was the year of the Civil War. People were desperate to be in contact with people they had lost. They believed it because the technology seemed so new and magical that they believed it could do anything.
And now, you know, with the rise of technologies like social media, you know, we were told that, you know, with Twitter and Facebook, you would have 10 million fact checkers. And so we're going to get a more accurate version of reality. But we also now have 10 million publishers putting out their own facts and theories all the time.
The internet is really challenging because it's so hard to know the difference. You go on one page and yes, it is a serious news organization that has fact checkers and has editors and has codes of ethics. And then you go to another page and it looks physically very similar, but it's got completely different approach to news, and it can be very hard for a casual browser to understand the difference. They seem to be similar, but the content can end up being radically different.
So the history is very good at telling us that the things we think of as dramatic and new might only be, you know, iterations of what's happened in the past. But are you really saying there's no difference between our current moment and earlier ones? I mean, specifically looking at the Trump administration, its relationship to the truth, its constant war with the press, are you really saying this is only just more of the same?
No, I think there are consequential differences in what's going on now in the Trump administration. Some very important and you know, nerve-wracking differences. I don't know of another time in which an administration so uniformly and vigorously and constantly works to undermine and diminish journalism as having any relationship with the truth. It is not even an argument about facts so much as an argument about you cannot trust those guys, they're deceitful, they're dishonest. It's a very emotional argument. And I think it leaves truth-telling no place to stand. And I find that really dangerous to the idea of a democracy.
And when you think about that that danger, is there a way for ordinary citizens to think their way through this? I mean, if you are an average person in the country and you constantly hear claims of fake news being hurled from every direction in every other direction, it's just easy to throw up your hands and say, you know, why should I trust anything?
That's a danger that worries me and many other journalists very, very much. It's really difficult. There are people who say that training in media literacy will help. There are people who say that news organizations need to be more transparent. In Europe, there are various governmental or quasi-governmental efforts to regulate what's available, what's possible. Malaysia has passed a law criminalizing fake news. Italy, you can report it to the police. These are all efforts, and I think we need to keep making efforts, but I'm not sure what will help other than the public, the citizenry, maintaining its vigilance and refusing to throw up its hands and give up, and insisting on reading with courage, with skepticism, with an open mind, and in engaging in open debate.
Speaking of government regulation, I want to end by going back to one of the earliest cases of fake news in American history. You describe a case from 1690, and you say that the story led to an extraordinary 14-year period when American newspapers published absolutely no fake news. What happened?
In 1690, the very first newspaper published in North America, Public Occurrences, he came to Boston, Benjamin Harris. He was from London, and he set himself up as just a guy named Ben who was going to publish a newspaper to tell the truth. And he had a list at the top of what he was going to do. I'm going to tell the truth. If I find that people are not telling the truth, I will expose them. I will give people the information they need. I will use only the best sources. So it sounded very modern. He then published a piece that claimed that the King of France, Louis XIV, was sleeping with his daughter-in-law, which, you know, could have been a mistake, but I think it was fake news in a very modern sense, intended to undermine the king because of the religious tensions at the time. The king was a fervent Catholic. Harris was not. Harris was a Protestant. I think he published that news knowing it was not true because the king didn't have a daughter-in-law, and did it in order to undermine the king. He was shut down. He was shut down immediately because this was seen as something impossible for an ordinary person to do, to be so critical, saying whatever he wanted. And then for the next 14 years, there was no fake news published in America because for the next 14 years, there were no newspapers published in America.
Andy Tucker is a professor at Columbia University. She's the author of Froth and Scum and a forthcoming book on fake news. Its working title is Misinformed. Andy, thanks for joining me today on Hidden Brain.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, even when people don't buy a local newspaper, why they still end up paying a price. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, a personalized weight loss program based in psychology for helping people change their habits and conquer their goals. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com. From the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children, and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org. And from the ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. We just discussed the long history of fake news and the tension between whether news organizations should think of their audiences as citizens or as consumers. If you missed that conversation with historian Andy Tucker, you can listen to it on the Hidden Brain podcast. The episode is called Fake News, an Origin Story. Now we turn to another story about news organizations and the communities they serve. Local newspapers are a trusted lifeline for many of us, especially amid the confusion and chaos of the COVID-19 pandemic. Reporters who venture out to hospitals and nursing homes in government briefings, they tell us what's happening in the world, in our country, and in our own communities. They let us track the spread of disease, the availability of ICU beds, the well-being of our neighbors. It should come as no surprise that in the past couple of months, print and online local newspaper readership has soared. Yet at this time, when the value of local journalism is most evident, when readers are inhaling article after article, newspapers are not thriving. They're collapsing.
Well, it is a difficult day for journalism in Cleveland. Today, the Plain Dealer newsroom went from 38 employees down to 16.
Well, North Dakota's two largest newspapers are taking steps to trim costs amid the coronavirus outbreak.
COVID-19 vaporized the paper's advertising.
Revenue is down more than 30%. 98 of the company's 375 employees have been furloughed or had their hours cut back.
The problem is only going to grow. Advertising revenue, which newspapers rely on, is vanishing as businesses shutter and people practice social distancing. For many publications, COVID-19 might be the final nail in the coffin. For decades, the financial health of many newspapers has been precarious, in good economic times and bad. If you talk to people who don't subscribe to their local paper, you can see why the industry is in dire straits. Here are some Denver residents we spoke with.
I've never subscribed to a local publication.
I usually just get the free ones like Westword.
Westword, the free one that comes out in the little red bins all over Denver. Love the coupons. That's what I wanted the paper for, is the coupons.
And I mean, Facebook has everything, so.
Their logic, and that of millions of Americans, is that there are lots of options to pay little or nothing to read the news. There are blogs, there's Facebook, there's Twitter. Why subscribe if you don't have time to read the paper? If you think the paper is biased? If you want to save money? All of this makes rational sense. Except it doesn't. That's because newspapers are not like most things we buy. If we decide not to buy an espresso machine, we save money. But if we decide not to pay for a police department, we might save money in the short run, but end up paying much more in the long run. Most of us treat newspapers like consumer products, but new research suggests they might be more like police departments. This week on Hidden Brain, we ask, who bears the cost when nobody wants to pay? In the winter of 2009, a few Denver-based reporters headed to a region of mountains and canyons called the Roan Plateau. Just a few years earlier, it was the site of an oil and gas boom. But that boom had turned into a bust.
So we were going up the Roan Plateau where many fewer workers were employed and looking at how people were struggling to try to keep things going and make ends meet.
Laura Frank was an investigative reporter for the Rocky Mountain News.
We were riding up with some of the oil and gas workers trying to get up the plateau. It had rained, and so the dirt road going up the plateau had turned really into kind of a muddy mess. And here we are sliding in this pickup truck trying to get up the plateau when suddenly we see these semi-trucks coming down the same road. And not sure what kind of control they were under. And I'm thinking, why am I risking my life for a newspaper that's about to close?
Laura was worried about the Rocky. Several weeks earlier, a balding man in a suit had stood in the middle of her newsroom. Reporters and editors clustered around in a circle. Many had their arms crossed. Some scribbled in notebooks.
This is a newsroom, so I doubt I actually need to give you the headline. Most of you probably already know, but we're going to announce just in the next few minutes that we're going to put the Rocky Mountain News up for sale.
Laura had listened to the announcement with dismay.
The newspaper was going to either be sold in the next 30 days or it would be closed. And if you remember what was happening in December of 2008, we knew we were on the verge either of a Great Recession or the next Great Depression. So I was pretty sure that they probably weren't going to sell the newspaper over the holidays in 30 days when no one knew what the economic outlook was really going to be.
Days after her reporting trip to the Roan Plateau, Laura got word about her fate at the Rocky. The same balding man in a suit gathered journalists around him.
Tomorrow will be the final edition of the Rocky Mountain News. Certainly not good news for any of you, and certainly not good news for Denver. Just want to make sure and say it's certainly nothing you did. You all did everything right. But while you were out doing your part, the business model and the economy changed, and the Rocky became a victim of that.
It was very hard to leave that night. I remember sitting at my desk for a very long time, just sitting there and not, you know, I was finished. There was nothing more I could do, but I didn't want to walk out of there.
The story about the oil and gas bust that Laura had spent weeks working on, it was scheduled to run that Saturday. The Rocky closed one day earlier, on Friday. When Laura left the Rocky newsroom for the last time, she was concerned about her own future, but she was even more concerned about the work she had left undone.
I had all of these stacks of documents on my desk at the Rocky Mountain News, each representing some issue that I thought needed investigating.
One of those issues was electronics waste, or e-waste.
The very week that the Rocky Mountain News closed, that last week of February in 2009, federal agents had raided an electronics recycler.
That raid came after a dramatic investigation by 60 Minutes.
Tonight, we're going to take you to one of the most toxic places on Earth, a place that government officials and gangsters don't want you to see.
A 60 Minutes investigation alleged this company had sent e-waste to China, where people were dipping parts in acid and burning them over open flames to get little bits of gold and other metals. And they were exposing the village to dangerous levels of lead. In fact, 70% of the kids in that village had dangerous levels of lead in their blood. So here you had an ongoing federal investigation into the role a Colorado company allegedly played in endangering kids in a foreign nation, and my newspaper was shutting down. We couldn't investigate, but the worst thing was no other local media had the capacity to investigate it either.
What happens when a newspaper isn't around to dig into stories of corruption and malfeasance? Like millions of people around the country, Denver's residents decided not to subscribe to their local newspaper for what seemed like perfectly good reasons. They were busy. The news was depressing. The paper was expensive. But these rational choices as consumers turned out to have serious consequences for them as taxpayers and citizens. You're listening to Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org. And from the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
There's a graph that I saw years ago that stood out to me so much that I now have it pinned to the wall in my office. It has a red line and a blue line. The red represents newspaper advertising revenue. The blue shows the number of newspaper reporters in the country. From 1980 to the early 2000s, ad revenue, the red line, rose and rose and rose. It peaked in the early 2000s. Then there was a cliff. As people canceled subscriptions and advertising revenue plummeted, so did the number of reporters, the blue line. Between 2006 and 2014, some 20,000 newspaper journalists lost their jobs. Now you can say, this is how capitalism works. Industries shrink, others grow. But is it possible that newspapers don't fit neatly into this economic model? That they have a different kind of effect on their communities? Finance professors Paul Gao, Dermot Murphy, and Chang Li were thinking about the effect of newspaper shutting down when they spotted something on YouTube.
We were watching this segment from this TV show called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver about the state of the local newspaper in the United States.
This is Dermot Murphy. John Oliver was explaining what Americans lose when newspapers disappear.
Watch how often TV news ends up citing print sources.
According to the Chicago Tribune.
According to the Detroit Free Press.
According to the San Francisco Chronicle.
According to the Times-Picayune.
The Boston Globe.
The Orlando Sentinel.
The Philadelphia Inquirer.
The Pittsburgh Tribune Review.
The Detroit News.
And the Houston Chronicle reports.
The Los Angeles Times reports. The Oklahoman reports.
The Hartford Current reports.
The Salt Lake Tribune reports.
It's pretty obvious. Without newspapers around to cite, TV news would just be Wolf Blitzer endlessly batting a ball of yarn around.
So as finance professors, we thought it would be important to look at the effect of newspaper closures on local communities from the finance angle.
The researchers had a hunch that the loss of newspaper jobs could affect municipal finance. Now, that sounds wonky, but let me explain why this is actually a big deal. Just as you borrow money from a bank to buy a house, towns and cities borrow money to build police stations, senior centers, and bridges. Taxpayers pay off these loans over time, just as homeowners pay off their mortgages. Dermot thought there might be a relationship between the cost of loans to cities and towns and disappearing newspapers. The researchers tallied every time a newspaper shut down between 1996 and 2015.
Once we had this information collected, we were able to see basically how government borrowing costs increase in the long run after a newspaper closure.
Dermot and his colleagues found that when a newspaper closed, the cost of loans in its county went up. This happened all over the country, including in Denver, home of the now-closed Rocky Mountain News. Dermot says one deceptively tiny number tells a significant story.
In the long run, after a newspaper closes, the borrowing cost for governments increases by about 0.1%.
Now, the interest rate on a loan increasing from, say, 3% to 3.1% may not sound like much, but here's how it adds up.
On average, a loan will be for $65 million in our sample.
If the cost of a loan goes up by 0.1%, that's about $65,000 more that taxpayers have to pay. $65,000 more every year. If the life of a loan is 10 years, that's about $650,000. And that's just for one loan. Cities and towns often have many loans like this. If a city has five projects, that's more than $3 million. If it has 50 projects, it's more than $30 million.
That does add up to real costs for the taxpayer.
The effect showed up even after the researchers controlled for population growth and differences in local economies. It affected areas that were booming and areas that were shrinking. Dermot thinks that borrowing costs go up because something important disappears when newspapers close.
The watchdog channel.
The watchdog role that journalists play in holding public officials and powerful corporations accountable. When a newspaper closes or slashes its reporting staff, there's no one to play that role anymore. It's like getting rid of the police officers who patrol neighborhoods. Elected officials appear to know this. When the Denver Post announced cuts in 2018, this report popped up in the news.
Another lawmaker joked about the cuts, saying, hey, that means we can do whatever we want, because fewer of the newspaper's resources may go to the watchdog role of covering lawmakers at the Capitol.
Dermot thinks the absence of watchdogs affects loan prices because banks realize their loans to local governments are now a little more risky. They know that some government officials will now be a little less honest, a little less careful.
Lenders are a little more nervous about lending to such a government. And so when a lender is more nervous about lending to an inefficient government, then they're going to have to ask for a higher interest rate on the money they're lending to compensate for that risk.
John Oliver had a similar theory, but he put it a little differently.
Not having reporters at government meetings is like a teacher leaving her room of seventh graders to supervise themselves. Best case scenario, Brittany gets gum in her hair. Worst case scenario, you no longer have a school.
You might be thinking here, okay, a lot of newspapers have closed, but there are now so many online publications. But these outlets do not appear to be an adequate replacement for a strong local newspaper. They are like having a community neighborhood watch. It's a wonderful complement to a police department, but it's not a replacement for a police department.
If the internet is filling in the gap left by local newspaper closures, then we wouldn't see borrowing costs go up like they are. We could even see them go down.
David Simon used to be a reporter at the Baltimore Sun. He also created the TV series The Wire. About a decade ago, he made a dire prediction as newspaper after newspaper laid off reporters. He testified before the U.S. Senate and said that online publications were not going to cover goings-on at City Hall and in state government.
That means that all of a sudden there's nobody covering the cop shop, nobody covering the zoning board. The day I run into a Huffington Post reporter at a Baltimore zoning board hearing is the day that I will be confident that we've actually reached some sort of equilibrium. The next 10 or 15 years in this country are going to be a halcyon era for state and local political corruption. It is going to be one of the great times to be a corrupt politician.
Legislators laughed, but David Simon was serious. He predicted that closing newspapers would lead to more corruption. We can see hints of this in Denver. While we can't know what would have happened if the Rocky was still around, some stories of corruption and wrongdoing might have surfaced earlier if there were reporters to keep an eye on things.
Mr. Acey, do you think you ought to go to jail for this? for cheating taxpayers in Adams County.
Rogers believes she was fired for being a whistleblower, helping her friend Michelle Edwardson, an animal control officer, write a complaint about then Chief of Police John Patterson.
We uncovered that DHS caseworker Rochana Madera, who was assigned to the case, never met with the family to make sure the baby was safe, and then she lied about it. 60 days later, Natalie was dead.
Remember, these are the stories that did get out eventually. We don't know what stories didn't make it out. While Dermot's study looked at the financial effects of newspaper closures, you can imagine all kinds of other things that are affected when a newspaper closes. Public health, the environment, political engagement. It's this last area that Stanford economist Matthew Gentzko has studied. He has examined how newspapers, prior to the advent of radio and TV, affected voter turnout.
You find that there are large positive effects of newspaper entry on turnout. So if you look at places where a newspaper entered, turnout increases in the following election. If you look at a place where a newspaper exited, turnout falls in the following election.
Matthew and his co-authors wanted to see if the results changed once radio and TV entered the picture.
The pattern is kind of interesting. I think what you see is that the role of newspapers in driving presidential election turnout gets smaller, as you might expect, given that now you no longer have to depend on newspapers. There are lots of other sources. Whereas the role of newspapers in driving congressional election turnout, local election turnout, or state level turnout remains large throughout that period.
The reason? If you want to learn about the presidential election, you won't have trouble finding information on cable TV. But those national sources are not going to help you learn what's happening in your state or county or city.
If you're trying to learn about the local congressional race in a particular district in Kansas, you can't learn anything about that from watching CNN. You can't learn anything about that from watching Fox News. And so the local newspaper in that part of Kansas is likely to be reporting a bunch of information about those races that is not reported almost anywhere else.
Matthew says local papers,
they remain incredibly important and unique in many, many places in terms of coverage of local politics and local elections.
It is local papers that have been decimated over the past two decades. And turnout in local elections looks no better. Portland State University found that in 10 of America's 30 largest cities, fewer than 15% of voters turned out to vote for mayor. Let me repeat that. Fewer than 15%. That makes turnout in the 2016 presidential election, 61% of eligible voters, seem sky high. For a variety of reasons, some of which we might not understand, newspapers appear to be vital to the civic and financial health of their cities, just like public schools or libraries or fire departments. But unlike those other services, newspapers are also private entities that must succeed financially in order to survive. In some parts of the world, taxpayers finance public interest journalism in the same way they pay for national defense, highways, and police. But Laura Frank, the former investigative reporter at The Rocky, says it's a bad idea for newspapers to get money from the government.
If a big part of the watchdog role that the Fourth Estate has is making sure that different levels of government are operating in a healthy and good way, we can't be dependent on those same levels of government to fund what we're doing.
Some newspapers are looking to individuals with deep pockets. Wealthy entrepreneurs have bought newspapers like the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times. Each is seeing a sort of renaissance. They've hired dozens of journalists. There's also been growth in public radio. Many local stations are expanding coverage. And then there are nonprofits. After The Rocky shut down, Laura started her own journalism outlet.
I wound up actually being given a fellowship at the University of Colorado, ironically, the Scripps Fellowship, named for the same family that owned The Rocky.
She used the Scripps money to create an organization called iNews.
And the I stood for investigative. And the idea was that we would do investigative stories and share them with other newsrooms. And that's what we did.
Remember the story about e-waste that Laura never got to finish when she was at the Rocky?
That was the first story. I put a reporter on the story who spoke Mandarin, and using a couple of different databases, we were able to track a shipment of e-waste from Colorado to Hong Kong. And our reporter was then able to confirm that this e-waste had been illegally exported. And that would have been an important story if we had stopped right there to say, you know, despite an ongoing federal investigation, illegal e-waste is still being exported to foreign nations. But we didn't stop there. We found that some of the same kinds of dangerous practices that were happening in China and Hong Kong, like dipping parts in acid and burning them over open flames, it was happening right here in Colorado on a much smaller scale, but completely under the radar of state regulators. They had no idea it was happening. And so that would have been an important part of the story, but we didn't stop there either. We found that most of Colorado's used electronic waste was actually winding up in local dumps instead of being recycled. And again, I feel like one of those commercials, but that's not all. We didn't stop there. We found much of the e-waste that was being illegally exported, locally dumped, or dipped and burned in Coloradans' backyards was actually coming from government surplus auctions. In fact, the very state agency responsible for regulating e-waste was sending its own trash electronics to auction.
That is unbelievable. They shared their reporting with news outlets across Colorado.
She dug into the story of what happens to old computers for iNews. It's a nonprofit investigative outfit in Denver.
And she found some of the government's trash computers wind up being shipped to developing nations, sent to the local dump, and even dismantled here in people's backyards and garages.
And the response was even greater than if the story had been published in just one newspaper.
Because of the way we were approaching this in a collaborative way instead of a competitive way, the story of Colorado's e-waste went from being a story that no media had the capacity to cover to a story that every major news outlet could share with their audience. It was in every daily paper. It was on television. It was on the radio. So suddenly we had this, you know, this statewide conversation about what was actually happening to Colorado's e-waste, and that had never happened before. And the state legislature then moved to close some of the loopholes that were allowing this to happen. So that's, you know, that's the way the fourth estate in a democracy is supposed to work.
This is clearly a success story. Laura lost her job at the Rocky, but that led her to set up iNews. She got stories like the e-waste investigation out to the public. The government made changes to the program in response. But Laura still thinks there is an immense cost when a newspaper closes.
It took 2 years for us to get the story out. So how many children were exposed and wound up with high levels of lead in their blood while we were trying to figure out a way to get the story out? Yes, I think when there's a really important story that a journalist somehow finds out about, it will eventually get out. But my God, who was harmed while we waited? And those are only the stories we know are going untold. It's the unknown unknown that is also very worrisome to me.
One of the bedrock assumptions of economics is that when individuals behave rationally, good things happen to them. Good things happen to their communities, their society. The invisible hand of the market takes all of our rational, selfish decisions and produces a society that flourishes. Much of the time, this does work. But it turns out that for things like police departments, public schools, and newspapers, the logic of the market doesn't produce the outcomes we want to see. We can all end up paying more when we all try, individually, to pay less. Many experts have tried to think of ways communities can solve problems that market forces don't solve on their own. How do you get people to pitch in, even when it's in their rational self-interest, to free ride off of others. These solutions begin with the same insight. Sometimes, when you try and pinch pennies, you end up paying in pounds. This episode was produced by Raina Cohen and edited by Tara Boyer. Our team includes Jenny Schmidt, Parth Shah, Thomas Liu, Laura Quirrell, Kat Schuknecht, and Lushik Waba. Special thanks to producer Meredith Turk for getting us the voices of the Denver residents you heard at the top of the show, and to Andy Huther for his engineering help. I'm Shankar Vedantham. See you next week.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, a personalized program based in psychology to help people understand their motivations, change their habits, and lead healthier lives. Learn more at Noom, NOOM.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from Americans for the Arts.